New information is now public that shows Broward sheriffs kept medics out of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. Did they put lives in danger? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. BSO sheriff deputies delayed the entrance of fire rescue medics into the campus to possibly help victims. We'll hear from the fire department about protocols in those sorts of situations. Plus, we'll talk with two researchers who found a link between events like Hurricane Irma and post-traumatic stress in children. The Florida International University researchers will also share some pointers for parents during these extreme events. And it's summer, and that means summer camps for kids. But what are camps offering families, and are there enough options for all families? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Fire department medics tried to get into Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School to find and assist the wounded. They tried, but they were denied numerous times by the Broward County Sheriff's Office. Authorities say it's because the shooter had not been captured or neutralized. Well, the BSO and Sheriff Scott Israel continue to face scrutiny over how they operated during the tragedy, and we've extended the invitation to the Sheriff's Office to respond to these accusations and have not gotten a response yet. But we are joined by the Sun Sentinel reporter Megan Omatz, who covered the story. Also, we're joined by Michael Moser, public information officer for the Coral Springs Police, Fire Department. Moser was the incident commander on the scene on February 14th. Megan Omatz, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate the time.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate being here.
And also, I just want to mention that she is joining us from the studios of WXEL in Palm Beach County. Also, Mr. Moser, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
And he is joining us via Skype. Megan, I'm going to start with you. When did this information become public?
Well, we can thank the Florida Sunshine Law for this, our open records law. The newspaper obtained these incident reports last week, released by Coral Springs under the law, which basically gave their detailed analysis of how they responded to this very tragic event at the high school. And what was particularly astounding in there is a very passionate explanation from Deputy Fire Chief Michael McNally about how he asked six times, he asked the BSO commander for permission to have these medics, teams of specially trained medics, to go in there to rescue children, treat them, bring them out, and they were denied. The BSO commander on the scene kept saying, I'll have to check whether they could go in. And from what we understand, of course, this was for the medics' own safety, and that BSO was not sure at that point where the shooter was, and they didn't want to put more people in harm's way. Of course, what we now know is that the shooter had fled with other children and was not in the building. So it's one more of these very sad situations that just seem to have been compounded in this case, where error upon error happened and failures in communication and just wrong turns at every turn.
Mr. Moser, you were there that day. I mean, kind of help us understand, I mean, for your perspective, what was going on?
You know, this incident was obviously the worst incident that this whole region has seen in probably, you know, the history of South Florida. And, you know, as cliche as it sounds, it started out as just an average day. We're doing various functions at the fire department. There were some units that were on calls. There were some units that were not on calls that were in station. We had some units training. And when the call came in initially as a shooting incident and then very quickly upgraded to what we believed is an active shooter situation, that's when, you know, there was a realization that this could be something very serious. And obviously we dispatched multiple units to the scene. I was one of the first arriving supervisors on the scene, so I established command, which is very common in our business to set an identified leader and somebody who's going to coordinate and orchestrate the scene from that point forward. For a brief time when I arrived, the incident was, we didn't really know what was going on, and it was very quiet there. It was almost eerie and surreal at the same time. There wasn't any patients at that point. There was dozens and dozens of police cars pulling into the scene from various agencies all across the county. Fire units that were there staging on the corner waiting to hear the news and to find out where these patients were located. Within a few short minutes, that's when patients began to present at the area that we had established as our command post and our medical staging area, or medical treatment area, I should say.
I wanted if I may, though, I wanted to ask, because you talk about you take this leadership post. You had multiple agencies there. Is one agency in charge? I'm trying to understand how you coordinate that.
Sure, and obviously that's a good question. It's not something that the average citizen's aware of, how the functions and the operations of police and fire departments operate. The fire department, on a fire-only incident, establishes command. They have a command structure. Each assignment is issued by the incident commander, and it's very closely watched and maintained. It's a very rigid structure, and it's the same goes for the police department. When they arrive on a police incident, sometimes they do the same thing depending on the seriousness or the gravity of the incident. In an incident like this, where we have police and fire departments involved, or any other agency for that matter, what the intent is to establish what we call unified command. We put a incident commander from the fire department together with an incident commander from the police department in a common location, and we communicate or we coordinate that way. And sometimes the incident commanders may not necessarily be together in the same room, but at the minimum, there is a liaison put in place to act as an intermediary between the two commands, so that there is one mission, regardless of whether it's law enforcement or fire rescue at that point. We each have our own specific responsibilities, but the mission is common, and we're able to communicate and we're able to function together that way.
All right. So, Megan, here we have, again, the Broward Sheriff's Office, the Coral Springs Police Department, Coral Springs Fire Department, and yet medics couldn't get into the school because the Sheriff's Office denied it. So they had total control? Is that the situation there? Why were they the ones that they had to ask for permission?
Yes, as I understand it, it was the Broward Sheriff's Office scene, and Mike was right. They needed to set up a unified command, and from what I can tell from the reports, they did not do that, or it wasn't done well. The deputy fire chief in his incident reports kept saying that he had to actually try to look for the BSO commander to get permission to go in. I mean, I think these unified command centers are set up for everyone's safety, to coordinate and share information, to make sure that tasks are getting done and that people are all on the same page. And if you don't have a unified command structure, that is where breakdowns can occur. And I think here there was also the compounded problem that they had difficulties with their radio communications. BSO has an antiquated radio system, and I don't believe that Coral Springs is on the same radio for both 911 and the communication system between emergency folks, but Mike can discuss that more. So you had all kinds of breakdowns in communication here, and it's a tragedy for these kids.
Let me, Mr. Moser, let me ask you. I mean, so were you all in the same location, or are you dependent on a radio system that has been questionable?
A little bit of both. So the fire department arrived within 5 minutes of the original dispatch time. And obviously the position that the police department takes up is different from that of the fire department. I pulled to the corner of Holmberg and Pine Island and set up our fire department command post there. The police department set up their command post. I'm not sure the exact time, but when they set up their command post, after that, they had set it up closer to the Sawgrass. So there is always an attempt to try to get the command posts put together. That is the intent. That's our priority at that point. But there are some times where that isn't the case. It's not available for whatever reason. I'm unsure why the sheriff's office set their command post up at a different location. Again, that wasn't a decision that I made, but there may have been a reason for that. But that's how we overcome that. Again, we sent from the fire department, Chief McNally became the liaison officer for this incident. Chief McNally went to the Broward Sheriff's Office command post and acted as that liaison officer between myself and the Broward Sheriff's Office incident commander to do exactly what I spoke about earlier. So in that situation where the command post couldn't be located together for whatever reason, we can overcome that by putting somebody there that can communicate between the two.
We're talking with Michael Moser, Public Information Officer for the Coral Springs Fire Department. He's joining us via Skype. We're also talking with Sun Sentinel reporter Megan Omatz, who's joining us from the studios of WXEL in Palm Beach County. Again, we're talking about this story where medics wanted to get into the Marjory Stoneman Douglas campus to look for anybody they might be able to help, but they were denied multiple times by the Broward Sheriff's Office. Again, we reached out to the Sheriff's Office to ask for comment or to join us in this conversation. We have yet to hear back from them. Mr. Moser, let me come back to you, though, if I may. I want to get an understanding of the training. What in these active shooter situations, what is the training? How are medics trained in the way they're supposed to go about doing what they do? Are you allowed into these settings in this situation?
There are certain situations where, yes, we would be. However, there is some criteria that has to be met. So there is a common model that was created after Columbine many years ago, and it's called the Rescue Task Force model. There are other names for it, such as Warm Zone Integration. There's other names for that particular model. But what it does is it pairs up paramedics with police officers so that they can enter a dangerous situation to extract patients out of a situation and bring them out to a treatment area and ultimately transport them. However, again, there is some caveats to that. This Rescue Task Force model, again, its nickname is a Warm Zone Integration. What that means is if at any time during this incident we believe or the police department believed that the shooter was still inside of the building, that is no longer a warm zone. That's a hot zone. That's an area where the shooter is still believed to be. This Rescue Task Force model is not acceptable in a hot zone. So, you know, we talk about the requests to deploy that Rescue Task Force and that request was denied by the Sheriff's Office. And we believe that decision at the time with the information that I as the incident commander knew was the correct decision in some ways because we could not confirm where that shooter was. There are one of three things that needs to happen before that hot zone becomes warm or cold where we can go inside. The shooter has to be confirmed deceased, the shooter has to be confirmed in custody, or the shooter has to be confirmed fled. Not one of those three things could be confirmed for quite some time after the incident. And again, as Megan talked about with the shooter blending and escaping very quickly after the incident, we did not know that information for quite some time. And because that could not be confirmed, that was the reason, in my opinion, that the incident commander did not allow us to enter the scene.
So, if I may, do you think then that you should never be allowed into a hot zone? Or because, look, you don't know, somebody may be bleeding out, and that short period of time you have, we talked about, you know, on this program with experts on these shooter situations, training medics like in war zones, like get them in, even in the danger. Do you think that there may have to come a time where, yeah, we're going to have to send you in even if it's a hot zone because you have a short period of time to save somebody?
Yeah, and it's a sad state of affairs that we have to think about even doing that in the future. And the possibility of that happening is a reality one day. But just to speak to the situation of going inside, you know, a firefighter and a paramedic's job is inherently dangerous. We know that. We understand that. We deal with that every day. But we also will not purposely send members into an area that we know to be an area that they could there would be a high likelihood that they could be injured or killed. And again, that's why we do it in a warm zone scenario where that particular building may have patients in it and may be not particularly safe, but because we know the shooter is not specifically in that building, then we would go in. So again, the future of fire rescue is a scary one that we may have to talk about doing that. And there are some things that we're doing in the meantime too. I'm sure you've heard through other media outlets that a lot of fire rescue agencies are donning bulletproof vests and other types of protective measures to deal with situations like this. And you know, when I started in this business 20 years ago, I would have never imagined that I would have had to put a bulletproof vest on. But at the same time, we're glad that that equipment is available. Obviously, it's expensive, and it's something that, that takes a lot of commitment for purchasing and training. But we're glad that we have the ability to have that equipment. Our equipment is being delivered as we speak, and we hope that we never have to deal with another situation like this. But if we do, we'll have some additional equipment on top of the safety equipment that we have now that'll help to protect us.
Megan, when did Broward Sheriff know that it was no longer a hot zone, that they could send people in? How long did it take?
I think it was about an hour until they got Nicholas Cruz into custody. And by then, according to what we understand, everyone who was still alive and could be brought out was brought out, so that the paramedics, there was no need for them to even go in at that point because all the remaining people were dead.
Have you heard from them? Again, we reached out to the sheriff's office, but have you heard from them? Have they responded on this?
They basically said that we should wait till their analysis and some other official investigations are completed. One thing I will mention is that we have heard that there were some SWAT medics, specially trained SWAT team medics in the building. I can't get a good handle on how many. I've seen maybe one name or two. These are folks that can, I believe, go into a hot zone, and maybe Mike can talk about that some more, but we don't have a good handle on how many of those folks were in there, and what their purpose is. We've heard that maybe their role is really to be helping in case a police officer is shot. Of course, they wouldn't overlook, I don't believe, any other kind of victim.
And just real quickly, if you could, Megan, just we've had the Parkland shooting, and then the year before that, we had the shooting at the airport. What is changing with the Broward Sheriff's Office and just communication overall between agencies? Because, I mean, one, we should be training in these things. Sadly, we've had two events that have kind of put us and forced us to deal with these issues.
Yes, and we saw some of the same failures in the Parkland situation as we did at the airport a year ago. And basically, emergency responders were all rushing to the scene. From what I can tell, there were problems with moving vehicles out of the way so that ambulances and so on could leave. People were parking everywhere. Obviously, we've already talked about the problems with the radio. BSO has purchased a new radio. It wasn't up and running, new radio system, in time for this event, but I don't believe that Coral Springs would be on the same system even when they get the new radio in place. And that is just really, really concerning in this day and age when everyone has to work together, how these folks are not all on the same radio system. And I'll say one other thing is that in the airport situation, it does not appear that there was a good unified command structure as well, and you had people stranded for hours and hours on the tarmac. Yes, the unified command structure was still a problem. Breakdowns with radio communication. Again, emergency vehicles all over the place.
Again, we've been talking with Sun Sentinel reporter Megan O'Matz and also Michael Moser, public information officer for the Coral Springs Fire Department. Thank you both so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And, you know, we'll keep following this story as more information gets out because, again, this is still being investigated by the state. Well, still to come, do hurricanes cause PTSD symptoms in children? And what as a parent, what can you do to help them? That's coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, hurricane season kicked off June 1st, and a campaign to prepare Florida for storms this year already underway. But the impacts of Hurricane Irma are still being felt. New research out of Florida International University examined hundreds of 9 to 10-year-old children in several sites across the state that were impacted by Irma. The preliminary findings show that children exhibited symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder following the hurricane. Now, these folks also studied the children at a site thousands of miles away from the hurricane's path, and They found that kids' minds were still being impacted there as well. Dr. Anthony Stephen Dick is a cognitive neuroscientist, and Dr. Jonathan Comer is a professor of psychology, both at Florida International University, and they recently presented their findings to members of Congress as part of the Coalition for National Science Funding, and they join us now in studio. Dr. Dick, Dr. Comer, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So first of all, let's understand this study. You had locations. You were looking at kids in Gainesville, Miami, Charleston, and San Diego. And I'm wondering, first of all, you know, what was the study? Why kids from all these different places?
Yeah. So this is an ongoing study called the Adolescent Brain and Cognitive Development Study, which is involved 21 sites around the United States. And what happened with this particular study we're looking at is there was about 2 years of ongoing data collection before the hurricane hit. And four of the sites are Florida International, Medical University of South Carolina, University of Florida at Gainesville, and University of California, San Diego, in addition to the other sites around the country. So we looked at this as an opportunity to see how, because the kids were involved in the study before the hurricane came, could we see how their brains are developing and how the behaviorally what their development looks like before the hurricane hits, and then again look at them after the hurricane hits to see if there's some changes in brain and cognitive function before and after the study was ongoing.
And are you looking at kids who had evacuated or kids who actually had to stick it out and go through the storm?
So we're looking at actually across sort of a spectrum of that. So kids who evacuated the storm, kids who had to stay in the home. And so what we did is we conducted a survey after the storm occurred to see what kinds of experiences kids were having.
You know, when we think about post-traumatic stress disorder, a lot of the times we link that to soldiers, police officers, people like that. But in children, I mean, how is that? How are we looking at PTSD in kids? Is it different?
Yeah, well, post-traumatic stress disorder and post-traumatic stress symptoms are probably more common in kids than people realize. In fact, it can look in some ways very similar and in some ways very different. So sometimes with a child, you might see repetitive play, a child who might have been in a terrible car accident. Instead of intrusive cognitions or thoughts about the event, you might see the child playing with toy cars and crashing the cars into each other. So you can see sort of post-traumatic play when you're observing these children.
And so, Dr. Comer, what are you seeing in these kids? What did the study show us about these kids and what they were experiencing after a hurricane like Irma?
Yeah. Well, I think first it's very important to mention that these findings are preliminary because we're going to be following these kids across 10 years. And so so the outcomes are still unfolding. And, you know, one of the big advances of this study is that, you know, disaster research has lagged behind other areas of research because disasters are unexpected. And so most research on kids affected by disasters are initiated after the event. So by piggybacking onto this very large scale national study, we've been able to look at what kids look like before the event and follow them across time. Importantly, the vast majority of kids who are confronted with extreme events like Hurricane Irma endure remarkably well. We see resilience. And then a small but sizable minority of kids show a range of emotional problems, which can include anxiety, depression, post-traumatic stress symptoms, and even aggression. Sometimes we see increases in aggression. When we talk about post-traumatic stress disorder and post-traumatic stress symptoms, we're often talking about sort of altered mood and thought. Sometimes we see a lot of avoidance of things that remind them of the event. We might also see sort of preoccupation and sort of persistent thought about the event. And also hyperarousal. We see a lot of kids are extra jumpy, might have more of an exaggerated startle response. And they might find that there are entire aspects of the event that they don't even remember. They have trouble recalling. They have these memory deficits that are very concerning.
Dr. Dick, have we seen studies on a massive scale looking at this particular issue, or is this the first of its kind?
This is really unique. There have been a lot of studies on kids' responses to disasters, but they're usually, as John is mentioning, sort of after the fact. There's one study that looked at kids' brain development before the Boston Marathon bombing, but it was a very small sample, so it was about 15 kids they looked at. So this study is a really large sample size study. Across the United States, it's about 12,000 kids who are involved in it. And in our just the sites that we're looking at, it's about 500 kids and families.
So. And Dr. Comer is talking about this is going to be, you're going to follow these kids for 10 years.
Yeah, so we're going to see how, and it's also, we have MRI scans on them to look at brain development. We have a lot of behavioral measures and sort of measures of their before Irma hurricane PTS symptoms, post-traumatic stress symptoms. So we can see if there's some risk factors associated with particular stress experiences before the hurricane. What is it? What are the kinds of factors that promote resilience to responses to disasters? We can look at a lot of those things.
So just as he mentioned, too, is the fact that, well, you know, Irma was barely not even a year ago. How long does it take before you start to see any kind of interesting behaviors in these kids? Dr. Comer.
Yeah, so it's really quite a spectrum. There's a lot of variability. For a lot of kids, they might seem to be doing quite well for several weeks, months, and then you'll see maybe 6 months later some very serious clinical impairments, especially as we start hurricane season again. Maybe kids have been doing well, but then they're sort of brought right back to the possibility of future hurricanes or other extreme events. And there are all sorts of events where kids can start to develop problems later on. And also, given the 10-year time frame of this study, it'll be really important to examine long-term trajectories, but also new hurricanes each year and how that interacts with the level of exposure, the dose of hurricane exposure that kids have had in years past. And this will be an exciting opportunity to try to understand those kids more.
So if we have another storm, mm-hmm. then they go through it again. And so you're just seeing how all of this piles up on top of what they've already experienced.
Yeah, exactly. You know, one of the very interesting things about disaster research or extreme events, people often focus on what exactly someone experienced during the event. But just as important in determining someone's clinical outcomes is their functioning and experiences prior to the event and the recovery environment after the event. And sometimes those are more important in determining whether someone's going to have some sort of prolonged emotional problems than the actual experience during the event.
We're talking with Dr. Anthony Stephen Dick, a cognitive neuroscientist, and Dr. Jonathan Comer, professor of psychology, both at FIU, and they're working on this research that we're talking about, the impact of storms and other tragedies on children. And they found that these sorts of experiences can create this PTS and symptoms in children. You know, both of you went to Capitol Hill to talk to lawmakers mm-hmm. recently. So I wanted to know, you know, what you were telling them in your findings and their response. What were they saying back to you?
Well, I think the lawmakers have been pretty open to trying to support national science funding in general for this kind of research. And that's very important that they keep doing that. And the lawmakers we met with, who are mostly South Florida representatives, and also Senator Rubio's office. They are obviously interested in seeing more of this kind of research done to see what is it we can tell first responders, families, and schools that what can they do to try and help kids sort of mitigate the kinds of PTS symptoms that you might see following these disasters. I think that's going to be one of the really important outcomes of this research is what can people do to help kids who are experiencing these kinds of disasters.
Dr. Comer, was there anything surprising about the visit? Anything that jumped out at you in those conversations?
Well, I think that the point we were trying to make is lots of money comes in to provide clinical services for kids and families affected by extreme events, and that's really to be applauded. But it's not necessarily clear that the money is being spent in smart ways unless we fund the research on the effectiveness of those approaches and we draw on what we've learned from past disasters. So what we were trying to really communicate and convey was the importance of funding science about understanding interventions, prevention services, which kids are most at risk. Because a lot of times after these events, a lot of well-meaning money comes in, but it's not being used in a smart way or an efficient way or in any sort of evidence-based way.
So how would this information, let's say, you know, for everyday real life, you know, situations, how could this information be used as we're now in a new hurricane season. So,
yeah.
You know, officials, authorities, people, as Dr. Dick said, you know, like schools, how could they use this?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, this sort of historic approach to understanding the effects of disasters on kids is focused on what we call sometimes the bullseye model, that the closer one is to the epicenter of an extreme event, the more affected they're going to be. And as you mentioned, we saw kids as far away as San Diego who were exposed to these events just by continuous news coverage and exposure, that it's important to not focus solely on who has had the highest dose of sort of direct exposure, but also to focus on kids with trauma histories. Those are some of the most vulnerable, kids with socioeconomic adversity going into the events, and kids who already have emotional problems, depression, anxiety. And so I think it can be, you know, in the sort of in the context of limited resources, we can focus sometimes on just the kids who are most directly exposed, and we really need to cast a broader net and be very smart about who we're trying to prevent problems in, and that's what this study is looking at.
And what about kids' relationships with their parents?
Yeah, especially in younger kids, they're often much more affected by how distressed their parents are than the actual damage to their home or their actual life threat. Kids don't always understand the larger issues when a disaster hits, so whether it's man-made or natural, but they can understand if their parent is stressed. They can understand if their parent is unable to cope.
Which this leads to, as I was looking through this list, you know, what parents can do to help their kids in these situations. And one of them is stay calm, because they're going to be watching you.
Yeah. And another one might be limiting media exposure, especially on television, that, you know, the more graphic media exposure. Like a lot of the research that John has done has shown that even, like he said, kids who aren't immediately exposed to the disaster, if they're exposed to media surrounding the disaster, that can affect their outcomes.
So a lot of news, in other words, whether it's about hurricanes or shootings or things like that, too much news.
Yeah.
Not good exposure. As you move forward in this study, I mean, now, you know, during hurricane season, you know, how much time are you spending looking at these kids? You know, what are you looking at? As you both have mentioned, it's not just what's happening after the storm, but before a storm. So what's happening now at this point in the study?
So this is an ongoing research study, and I do want to point any families of 9 and 10-year-olds, if they're interested in participating, they can go to abcdstudy.org or call 305-348-ABCD to be involved in the study. But what we're doing currently is, it's as John mentioned, it's an ongoing study over the next 10 years. It's funded by the NIH. So we're continuing data collection on the kids who were involved in the Irma sub-study, and also data collection on the kids more broadly.
You know, in the state of Florida, in a state like Florida, I should say, where hurricane season is just a regular occurrence, I mean, what are the biggest concerns that we have surrounding the, you know, that trauma happening again and again? I mean, I kind of brought this up with you, Dr. Comer, a second ago, but it's just that re-traumatization again and again and again and again. It's just part of life here.
Yeah. Well, I think a couple things. I think we need to be cautious not to treat every storm like the Category 5 storm, because I think that the news tends to increasingly recognize that coverage of extreme events draws a lot of viewers. And I think that that can perpetuate a sense of danger, even when obviously Hurricane Irma was extremely concerning for the whole state of Florida in the lead up. But there are a lot of other storms that are not nearly as big, that are way out in the ocean, that are going to dissipate before they hit landfall. And we're covering them the same way as though Katrina or Irma were coming. And so I think we need to do a better job in that regard. Also, another concern is, in addition to just traditional media, is social media, which is not governed by the same sense sort of ethical standards or journalistic standards that we see more print traditional media or television media. And there can be lots of misinformation online. There can also be more vivid images that are not necessarily newsworthy themselves, but just being circulated online. And one thing we found with other disasters after the Boston Marathon bombing and some of our early findings with Irma is how much social media specifically may be associated with serious emotional problems in kids exposed to that.
All right, real quickly, Dr. Dick, put that number out there again, because if you have families with kids between 9 and 10,
yep,
want to take part in the study, they can do what?
305-348-ABCD, or they can email abcd fiu.edu.
All right, and we'll put that information too up on our Facebook so that people can look, check it out if they missed that. Again, Dr. Anthony Stephen Dick, cognitive neuroscientist, and Dr. Jonathan Comer, professor of psychology, both from FIU, looking at this, the impact that storms, tragedies have on kids, and they are also going to be struggling with some PTSD symptoms as well, just like adults do. Gentlemen, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, it's summertime. That means summer camp. But are there enough camps out there for all kids? That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, school's out for the summer, and kids are going to be looking for things to do, and parents need to keep them occupied. Summer camps are a place for kids to try new things and remain active. But for those with kids, it takes loads of preparation. There's a bounty of options across South Florida, but what programs are right for your kids? And, of course, which ones are affordable? Joining me now in studio, I've got Rhonda Smith, the founder of a specialty camp and nonprofit called Fit Kids. Rhonda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. May I just make a slight correction? It's Fit Kids of America.
Thank you, Fit Kids of America. And Lauren Butler, who is in the Education Division Board for the Urban League of Broward County, which hosts the Summer Enrichment Program.
That's right.
Lauren, welcome.
Thank you.
Also, joining us by phone, we have Emily Cardenas. She's the Director of the Communications at Miami-Dade's The Children Trust. Emily, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
All right. And of course, we want to hear from you. Are you sending your kids off to camp? What sort of camp are you looking for? What's the affordability question for you? If you can't pay for it, what other options are there? We'd like to hear from you. Give us a call, 800-743-9576. Again, that's 800-743-WLRN. You could also tweet us or message us on Facebook. Just look up WLRN Sundial. All right. You know what? Let's start with this. I want to get a sense of what camps are for. Why send your kids to camp? What are they getting out of it? So let's Lauren, Emily, Rhonda, I want to start with I want to hear from all of you on this one. But Rhonda, let me start with you. Why camps?
Number one is to keep the children engaged. And particularly the summer, there's a wonderful opportunity to impart enrichment activities, something they don't get all year. We specialize, as our name says, and our love is fitness and sports. Most children, unfortunately, don't have any kind of regimented activity. So it's an opportunity for us to show them the world of health and wellness. So if they to inspire them, if they are not getting it during the school year, Right. Well, we intend to teach them, to motivate them and guide them to a healthier lifestyle.
So for you specifically, I mean, in your camps, it's about fitness and getting the kids, getting them in shape or just teaching them healthy habits?
Both. I mean, we run a camp that's 9 weeks, so there is definitely improvement. We do assessments. It is for them alone to know. It's called a PACER assessment. It's an evidence-based, we use evidence-based programs, and we use a multidisciplinary approach to fitness. So it's not just one sport or one activity. We want to show the children the difference of aerobic to anaerobic, strength training, the benefits of stretching, doing a warm-up, a cool-down. So we use it not only to do the activity, but also to teach them.
Keeping kids active.
Yes.
Keeping kids active. All right. Lauren, real quickly, I mean, that question of this idea of what is the benefit of going to a camp, maybe if it's not one for fitness, but even just any kind of camp, what's the benefit?
So I would definitely agree with what Rhonda said on various points. But I think safety is also a big concern for the parents, where their children are going to be during the day. When they're in school during the academic year, obviously they're in school and they are definitely kept safe by their teachers and school officials and so forth. But over the summer, what happens? Who's actually like available to be there to provide that safeguard for the children? So safety is one.
It's about having a place for the kids to be, because if not, they would be at home.
Exactly.
And no supervision.
Right. No supervision. The other thing, of course, the engagement. With our camp specifically, there is an academic component. We're firm believers in education, and we do believe that if you don't kind of use it, you kind of lose it. And so over this summer, you know, it's a opportunity for them to not feel that stress of having to test and so forth, but just to be exposed. So this year, the Children's Services Council has moved from an untraditional, like a traditional way of learning. And children are used to the regular instruction with a teacher in front of them, chalkboard, you know, dry erase board and whatnot. But this year we're doing project-based learning. So it's really cool. What they're doing, everything is more so hands-on. They're getting to build websites and to just do various different projects that incorporate reading and math, but through an untraditional way of learning. So a way to just keep them engaged, a way to keep them safe. The children that we have coming to our camp, at least the majority of them, have come to camp year after year after year. So they look at it also as a meeting place for their friends. You know, so the social aspect of it is also important.
So having a place for these kids to be, so there's some supervision, and of course, keeping that engagement going, but also keeping them busy, or they would just probably veg out over the summer.
There you go.
Because I remember always doing as a kid. Emily, real quickly, I wanted to get your take on
that
as well.
Well, there's something that our last guest was referring to when she said either you use it or you lose it, and that's called officially the summer slide or the summer learning loss. Research has absolutely indicates that if we're not engaged in a structured summer camp experience, can lose up to 3 months of math and reading skills. And so if they're sitting at home vegging or running the streets, many kids will start school having forgotten about 3 months worth of what they learned. And if years go by and you have 3 months of learning loss every year, the fact of the matter is you don't really lose it. So you keep adding 3 months, 3 months, 3 months, 3 months, pretty soon there's a kid who's a year behind their peers academically. So it's very important that they be in a structured camp environment.
Again, I'm talking with Rhonda Smith, founder of a specialty camp and nonprofit called Fit Kids of America, Lauren Butler, who's in the Education Division Board for the Urban League of Broward County, and joining us by phone, Emily Cardenas, Director of Communications at Miami-Dade's The Children Trust. And we're talking again about summer camps and, you know, what's available to kids. What's the plus of sending your kid off to camp? But also, what are the challenges of finding the right camp? There's so many, but what about affordability and finding one that offers the right sorts of programs for your kid? We'd like to hear your thoughts. Give us a call, 800-743-9576. Rhonda, did you want to ask a question?
I wanted to add to it.
No, go ahead.
Unfortunately, I wasn't able to hear what Emily had to say. I'm sure it was very important. As a extraordinarily proud provider for the Children's Trust, we treat the whole child. The Trust has done various studies that demonstrate that during the summer, children can lose one grade level, one reading level of, you know, accomplishment from the school year. The adverse is true, too, where we can gain. We can make educational gains. So we are committed, although our area of expertise is in fitness and sports, we're committed to treating the whole child. So during the summer, we do have an array of different evidence-based reading curricula where whether it's fluency, comprehension, to engage the children and to keep up those reading levels.
So it's not just a place to send your kid and throw your kid out for a few months so that they're not hanging around the house playing video games, doing nothing. This actually is keeping them, it's keeping their minds also engaged so that when they go back to school, they're going to be much more prepared.
Absolutely.
They're not going to lose a lot of the stuff.
We have commitment to that, to the terms of, as I said, with fitness and sports. We also do a pre-assessment and a post to see if we're doing a great job.
Let me ask about this, though, is, you know, I was going through it. I'm not a father, so I don't, you know, this is not something that hits me, but I have friends who are parents. And of course, they talk about camps. And the first thing that they talk about is affordability. And for some parents, it's not a big deal, but obviously, there, folks, that's such a $100 a week could be a lot. So, I mean, when it comes to accessibility and affordability, you know, how do we help all parents? Are there options for everybody? I mean, you know,
so,
Emily, go
ahead. If I may, there are, thanks to organizations like the Children's Trust and the Broward Children's Services Council and the Palm Beach Children's Services Council, we really changed the game in this arena. There are tens of thousands of opportunities for children to attend either free or very low-cost summer camps that did not exist a decade ago. Having said that, it's never enough. What you have is you have a lot of kids who are in after-school programs now, and they transition straight into the summer camp. These organizations are running 365-day-a-year programs, and the kids that are in there at their locations during the academic school year get first crack at the summer camp slot. So that means that they fill up fast, and parents who wait until the last minute, and I would say this is about the last minute. You got to get started, you know, March, April, May. But if you waited until now, it's going to be hard. But so you might not get your first choice, but you can find them, and you can find affordable camps. You just have to dig. And I would tell parents that you need to budget for this, like you would budget for a new car, or not that you're going to pay the price of
the
car,
but the way
you budget to pay your electric bill, okay. And the way you budget, you need to budget for camp.
Lauren and Ron, but I want to hear from both of you quickly about, you know, what are some of the concerns you hear from parents on this? I mean, do you ever run into a parent who says, I'd love to, but I can't?
You know, honestly, we don't necessarily experience that challenge at the Urban League. Reason being is because we are funded by the Children's Services Council.
Okay.
And our program, at least on the elementary side, is based on a sliding scale fee. So it is based on the family's income as well as the family size. So it is significantly reduced as compared to other programs available in the local towns or just local cities. It is definitely, definitely affordable. And even though sometimes it is low, you find that there are some parents who can't even afford the $20 a week. Sometimes that is the challenge. So we do treat every family on an individual basis. And sometimes it does require a waiver for some of the families. But nevertheless, we're committed to our families. We've worked with them for years. We're definitely dedicated to the community, so we do what we can to make sure that the children have a safe place over the summer.
Rhonda, what do you tell parents about the questions they should be asking, just real briefly? What should they be looking for to make sure they found the right camp for their kid?
Well, number one is knowing your child, the needs of your child.
But is it the needs, or do you have to ask your kid, hey, what do you want to do this summer?
Absolutely. Okay. There definitely should be ownership. I really advocate, I'm a child advocate. Mm-hmm. So I like the children to come in, tour my facility. Mama's paying, but my customer is the child. That's my boss. So I want to make sure it's the right fit. But also concerning funds and so forth, we are blessed because we are generously funded by the Children's Trust. We use those funds to acquire the best teachers and PE coaches money can buy.
Only because of time. Special
yes.
needs kids. What about those needs? Are those also being met?
We welcome children of all
right.
abilities. Our door is always open, and we love every child, and we will make accommodations for every child.
Absolutely.
So those, because sometimes you need a specialist in some cases. That's available?
We honestly have, I will say I've been with the Urban League for a little bit over a year now, and that has not been my experience. We have had some children that have had some special needs, but it really didn't go past maybe like an ADHD or slight autism. So we haven't had anything extreme. However, we do work very closely with the Children's Services Council to make sure that all children are served equally, including those who have disabilities.
And so Emily, real quick. Yeah, Emily, real quickly.
Yes,
just
I was
going
to say that all of our programs are supposed to accommodate children of every need. But as a parent, you need to ask if you have a child that is wheelchair bound and so forth and so forth. You need to find out if the program can accommodate your child and has the appropriate staffing for that. And by the way, even for typically developing children, when you're looking for a camp, besides considering your child's interest, which is critical, you also need to find out what the experiences of the staff, what the child-to-teacher ratio is, so that that environment is as safe as it possibly can be.
Emily Cardenas, Director of Communications at Miami-Dade's the Children Trust. We also heard from Lauren Butler from the Education Division Board for the Urban League of Broward County, and Rhonda Smith, founder of the specialty camp nonprofit called Fit Kids of America. It is summertime, so it is time to think about what your kids are going to be doing over the summer. Let us know what your kids will do over the summer, or if you've got questions, maybe we can link you to any of these folks, and they can help you find those answers. Just find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial. Rhonda, Lauren, Emily, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And please, everybody, download our app on your phones or visit thechildrenstrust.org to find a program for you.
All right. Have a wonderful summer and have a wonderful day. Talk to you tomorrow.